Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on July 9th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus video update and Q&A. New updates are live streamed on Facebook every Thursday at 12 p.m. ET.
Hello and welcome to this week's coronavirus update with Life Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanice and I'm a health reporter at the site. And I'm here to answer your questions about COVID-19 and the ongoing pandemic. I usually start off these live streams with a quick update on news from the week, new developments in the science of clinical trials, of what we know about the virus, et cetera, et cetera. If you would like to know what updates I'll be giving this week, you can check out the caption of this video, and we've included a table of contents for you there. Just to give you a quick update on case counts, worldwide, we're now seeing that over 12 million confirmed cases have been reported globally, and more than 550,000 deaths worldwide. Within the United States, we have reported more than 3 million cases at this point, and more than 132,000 deaths within the country. If you would like to double check how those deaths are counted within the U.S., what qualifies as a death caused by COVID-19. We do have an article explaining that process and how the death certificates are processed. So please look up that article to learn more about those details. So just to kick us off, I wanted to talk about connections between brain inflammation in some cases of COVID-19. It's unclear how often we're seeing neurological complications of this kind in connection with COVID-19 infection, but it has cropped up often enough, and we saw this earlier in the pandemic as well, that neurologists especially are keeping an eye out for it and are learning more and more about how the virus can potentially affect the brain. So a new study came out from the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London, which is part of the University College London. And they reported numerous cases of delirium, brain inflammation, nerve damage, and strokes attached to COVID-19 cases. So this was in a sample of 43 patients, so not an enormous study. But one of the symptoms, one of the complications that arose is one that is generally fairly rare in adults. They see maybe one case a month typically, and they're now seeing about 4 cases a month or 1 case a week in comparison as connected to the rise in COVID-19 cases. So this particular relatively rare condition among adults is called acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. If you don't want to say that mouthful, the acronym is ADEM. So this is a rare and sometimes fatal neurological condition, which results from severe inflammation especially. And they found about 12 or so patients among these 43 who developed this syndrome. So that is something that they're alerting other neurologists to have them look out for, especially in connection with COVID-19, as this is a recognized syndrome and they have specific routes of treatment for it. In addition to this syndrome, they also saw 8 people with nerve damage as a result of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune disorder that arises often after an infection of sorts. So this may be either a respiratory infection or some sort of gastrointestinal infection. And COVID-19 can both affect the respiratory system and gastrointestinal system. So it's not necessarily surprising that such a syndrome could arise from COVID-19, but we are seeing instances of that. And that nerve damage must be treated in a specific way as well. We're also seeing, this has been noted numerous times before, but strokes in patients linked to blood clots caused by the virus. And this, those blood clots may emerge for a variety of reasons. It's unclear exactly why at this point, but it could be that given that blood vessels have the ACE2 receptor on their surfaces, meaning that the virus can plug into those receptors and thus open up a gateway into the cells. Because they bear those ACE2 receptors, blood vessels themselves might become infected directly, and that would potentially cause blood clots. In addition, amplified inflammation and other involvements of the immune system can kick off that coagulation, because coagulation and blood clotting is actually associated with the immune system getting rid of viruses, because those clots capture pathogens. So to a certain extent, they're helpful, but when they run out of control, clearly they are no longer helpful and can cause things like strokes. All tied up in this, when you see these types of brain abnormalities arising from viral infections specifically, you might see temporary brain dysfunction, which is sometimes immediately reversible in terms of when the virus clears, those symptoms go away. So they also saw that within the study. So they saw about 10 cases of so-called encephalopathies, which just describes temporary brain dysfunction, which can manifest as delirium or confusion, disorientation. And we actually reported on a case of such a syndrome back in March. So this is an unheard of connected to COVID-19, but all just things we're continuing to think about and learn more about as the pandemic goes on. Moving into our next update for the week, there are several antibody-based treatments that have now moved into human clinical trials. So I did want to touch on what the deal with those is and how far along they are. So most progressed is a treatment called REGEN-COV2, which is spelled REGN-COV2, which is developed by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. So this is a drug that we actually featured in a story this week, but there are other very, very similar drugs in trials as well, developed by other pharmaceutical companies. So it is not a unique drug in that respect. But these drugs work using a similar strategy to what's known as convalescent plasma therapy. So you may have heard of plasma therapy in terms of people having their blood plasma drawn who have already recovered from COVID-19 and therefore have antibodies circulating. Antibodies are these Y-shaped molecules that can latch onto a specific pathogen and help the immune system to target it, to clear it from the body, but also some of them prevent that specific virus from infecting further cells. So they work in a variety of ways. But people who have recovered from COVID-19 bear these antibodies, and you can draw their plasma and then inject that plasma donation into someone else. And that is known as convalescent plasma therapy. So the idea being that you give the antibodies to a sick person to help them fight off the virus, because their body is currently building those antibodies. And if you just give it to them pre-made, that can help boost that immune response. So they're finding that is successful, but plasma therapies rely on plasma donations, which are, of course, in limited supply because only certain people can donate blood plasma, depending on, of course, you require informed consent. You have to be of a certain age. Your blood must be cleared after being donated, be tested for other viruses, etc. So there is a limitation to the supply of plasma, but also because each person will generate a different collection of antibodies that come in many different types, as I said. Some antibodies may be more efficient at clearing the virus than others. So when you're drawing plasma from one person and giving it to another, it's not guaranteed that that particular mix of antibodies is the perfect formulation to help them fight off the virus. So there's differing efficacy between plasma donations. So to sidestep those limitations, people study the antibodies both drawn from human patients, but also in genetically modified mice to pinpoint which antibodies are most potent against the virus in terms of neutralizing it and stopping the course of infection. And then you can generate those antibodies in the lab without having to rely on plasma donations anymore. So naturally, that makes the therapy more widely applicable and easier to scale up en masse like we would require. So this new drug developed by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals did just that. It contains two fairly potent neutralizing antibodies that they found by looking at these genetically modified mice, but also by looking at antibodies from human patients. And they will be using it in a phase 3 clinical trial, meaning they're looking at how effective it is and how safe it is in a large number of people. So they're going to be giving this to about 2,000 people across 100 sites in the US. And in this particular trial, they're seeing if the antibodies can help to prevent people from catching COVID-19. So as a preventative treatment rather than given after the fact. And it will be given to people who have had close contact with an infected person, like one of their housemates, for instance. The drug will also be tested as a treatment against the virus in sick people. So both hospitalized people and ambulatory patients who are not hospitalized and are able to move about their daily lives more freely. All of those trials are ongoing, and we should have more updates on that front within the next few months. But as they've progressed to phase 3 and phase 2-3, which is a step below, that means they've already graduated from early safety trials, so they don't seem to garner serious side effects that would need to be corrected before they are given to a wider population. And they show some efficacy, at least, in doing what they're meant to do within the body. So now we're just seeing how effective they are in more real-world scenarios. And just to wrap up this week's updates, this is not a story that's published on the site yet. It is forthcoming, but I thought I'd give you a little preview. There has been a new study, a new preprint published, that was an observational study. I'll start off by saying that. So this is simply taken from survey results. So there's always a bit of a grain of salt you need to apply to studies of this nature. It's not the gold standard clinical trial or anything like that. But they're finding some link between the use of proton pump inhibitors, which are a very commonly used heartburn medication, and an increased risk of catching COVID-19. Now, before anyone panics, this is not a reason to throw out all your proton pump inhibitors. I spoke with the author of this study already, and he said, quote, "By no means do we say that people need to stop their PPIs," short for protein pump inhibitors. So just to give you that at the forefront, but they're, of course, the purpose of these heartburn medications is to reduce the amount of stomach acid in your body so you don't experience heartburn. And these are they're very potent medications. So you may have also heard of histamine 2 blockers or H2 blockers. This is a form of heartburn medication it does not have as dramatic an effect on your stomach acid. So on kind of a sliding scale, H2 blockers are considered less potent than protein pump inhibitors. And because protein pump inhibitors are so effective at reducing the amount of stomach acid, they can actually make the body vulnerable to infections because stomach acid serves to burn up and kill off pathogens as they enter the body that could infect the intestines, for instance. So we've seen in the past some connection between the use of PPIs and infection by various bacteria, including C. difficile, but it's common in hospital settings. In any case, so we've seen this connection before between PPIs and an increased risk of infection because you don't have that barrier of stomach acid to kill off those pathogens. And that it makes your stomach more basic, meaning less acidic, and that is sustained over a long period of time because PPIs, in effect, permanently block the proton pumps that they come in contact with. And these proton pumps, the stomach rebuilds continuously, so there's turnover. So the only reason they fade off or their efficacy goes away is because there's new proton pumps to raise the amount of stomach acid in the body again. So that's why they're so effective and great for severe acid reflux and heartburn and for people who have peptic ulcers in their stomachs. So all good reasons to take PPIs, but they could also leave you somewhat at higher risk of catching COVID than people who do not take these medications at all. Now, they didn't see this rise in risk in connection with the H2 blockers, likely because they do not lower stomach acid as dramatically as PPIs. So if you're on PPIs, the take-home message is to, number one, ask your doctors if you need a PPI or if an H2 blocker could be sufficient. If you do need to be on PPIs, and you would know that better than anyone, given whatever condition you're using them to treat, do you need to be taking one a day, which is usually recommended, or some people take two a day, and that was connected with the highest risk of catching COVID. So if you don't need to be taking two a day, it would be better to be taking only one a day. And there hasn't been a lot of evidence that taking two a day is actually more helpful for most patients. So that's another question you can ask your healthcare provider. So just asking questions of that nature would be appropriate at this time, since we do see some tenuous connection. By no means does taking PPIs mean you will catch COVID-19. There's just a very slight rise in risk associated with them. So just to give you that background for anyone who takes those medications. And on that note, I'm going to move into answering your questions. I'm getting a question. This person's family members and themselves are all positive for COVID-19 right now, and they are asking whether they will have to worry about becoming infected again at some point in the future, or if they will be completely immune to the virus following this point. And the answer, unfortunately, is that we don't know for sure. What they think is, evidence suggests that most people, the vast majority of people, build specific antibodies in response to becoming infected. Even if that infection is very, very mild or asymptomatic, the presence of antibodies is still there. The big question is, how long do those antibodies hang around? And how do they translate to long-lasting immunity? The opinion among epidemiologists right now and virologists is that the presence of especially neutralizing antibodies, which are those that stop more infection from occurring in the body, so they latch on to the virus directly and prevent it from causing further infections to new cells. It's thought that the presence of neutralizing antibodies does make one immune to the virus for some length of time. The big question is how long? And given that even now, we've only been in the midst of this pandemic for about 6.5 months or so, we don't know how long immunity lasts in people who have recovered from COVID-19. So that's a big question. With past coronaviruses, there are 4 common coronaviruses that circulate every year and cause symptoms of the common cold. So those naturally use humans as their host. And we see that people can become infected with those viruses recurrently. So immunity doesn't last forever. The question is how long until that immunity wears off, and that's unclear at this point. There was also evidence in studies of the related coronaviruses that jumped from bats into people. So these were SARS-CoV and MERS-CoV, which again are related to the SARS-CoV-2 virus we now see. Studies of those viruses suggested that immunity could last between about 1 and 2 years before it wears off, and then you could become vulnerable to reinfection. The same trend might be true of this new virus, but we don't know for sure yet. For now, in the midst of the pandemic, it's best if everyone continues to social distance until we know more and exercise caution as you have throughout the pandemic, regardless of whether you've caught the virus already or not. I'm going to hop to a related question. Someone's asking, there have been some studies that suggest that certain populations of antibodies disappear fairly quickly following a COVID-19 infection. These studies still need to be verified thoroughly, just so you have that context. So we're not sure, number one, what the drop-off in antibodies really means for immunity. And I haven't seen studies that break it down between, there are many antibodies come in many different flavors, so it's important to know which antibodies are becoming diminished and which are persisting. Because if you still have a large number of neutralizing antibodies that hang around, then that could be great for immunity, even if other types of antibodies are dropping off. So those questions still abound. But the core of your question was getting at, what could that mean for the longevity of a vaccine? The whole idea behind a vaccine is you prompt an immune response in the body as if the person's caught the real pathogen, the real virus in this case, and the body mounts an immune response, namely antibody-driven, but also other related immune responses in response to that vaccine. So if they come across the real virus at any point, then the body has already learned how to fight it off. And that's the whole idea behind vaccination. So if we see a drop off with immunity with natural infections, why wouldn't we see that with a vaccine? And the answer is we might see that with the vaccine, but we've been able to deal with that in the past as well. The seasonal influenza vaccine is a different example on this front, because in that respect, we're seeing different strains of a virus emerge, which is not what's happening here. But the point is that you're seeing new formulations of a vaccine come out year after year after year. So you may see something similar with a coronavirus vaccine, where you have to go then get a booster or get a new version of whatever the first vaccine ends up being. And I think that's to be expected, is that the very first coronavirus vaccine might not be the last one you ever get. It might not be the most potent, given how quickly we're building it, especially. But given that it will progress through thorough safety and efficacy trials, you can at least trust that it will do a good enough job. But most likely within the next 5-10 years, you're going to see multiple iterations of a coronavirus vaccine comes out, and likely booster shots, depending on how that immunity lasts. So that's a great question. Also a good question. Someone is asking about the D614G mutation. I believe most people just call it the G mutation for short, but correct me if I'm wrong. But this mutation has been found to be among the most abundant that we're seeing in the virus. So it's almost like a tag marking the most widely circulating lineage of the virus. And I say lineage deliberately, because while this mutation appears highly prevalent, we don't actually know if it confers an advantage for the virus in any way. We don't know if it significantly changes its function at this moment. Just because this lineage happens to be highly abundant doesn't mean that lineage is the most transmissible. A lot of viral infection has to do with opportunity for the virus to infect, right? And part of it is biased by, for instance, this was a strain lineage, rather. The reason I'm being so careful about lineage versus strain, a lineage says that, yes, this virus is mutating through time, just like every virus, and you can track those mutations like you do branches on an evolutionary tree, and each branch represents a new lineage, and they continue to mutate on their own through time. Now, a new strain represents a dramatic enough mutation that the virus behaves much differently than it did before. So, for instance, the H1N1 influenza virus, we see new strains emerge, and then we have to deal with them with new vaccines and all that sort of thing. This appears to be a new lineage of the virus. And when I say new, I don't mean new. I just mean new as compared to the original version of the virus that we knew about. But it was highly prevalent in Europe, and that might be in part because you have to imagine briefly that the virus is being exported from its original place, likely somewhere in China, to other countries. So whichever lineage happens to latch on at a given location and set off an outbreak, that one may become the most prevalent because it's the one that set off the outbreak to begin with. And if it persists, there may be various reasons for that. And that might be the case with this mutation. It might just have been a matter of opportunity for that lineage that it stuck around and became so prevalent at all. All that said, we don't have concrete evidence at all that this mutation makes the virus more transmissible. Also, the mutation has been around for, in the context of the pandemic, quite a while now. We'll learn more about that once they conduct more in-laboratory studies of how that mutation connects to protein construction and the actual function of the virus. But from these observational studies and genetic surveys at this point, you can't garner that information. I'm getting a question about vitamin D supplementation and why health officials do not specifically encourage it as a way to improve your immune function. There's lots of literature online connecting vitamin D deficiency to poor immune function. So certainly if you have a vitamin D deficiency or if you're not getting enough through your diet naturally, supplementation is a great way to go. And that's something to discuss with especially your healthcare provider, but perhaps a nutritionist, things like that. So that's kind of an individual decision to see if you need extra vitamin D through supplementation. The reason it's not highlighted as a particular coronavirus preventative is because vitamin D simply supports a normal functioning immune system. There's no evidence at this point that taking vitamin D supplements, especially people in their homes typically take them through oral supplementation, and it could be if you were to get it through a different route of administration in a hospital setting, that would be a whole different scenario. But the point being that while vitamin D deficiency is definitely bad, there's not strong evidence suggesting that taking a ton of vitamin D supplements is going to protect you any more against the virus than if you just maintained a good diet and slept adequately and remained hydrated as needed, all that sort of thing. So vitamin D supplementation, I can say, is, of course, if you have a deficiency, a great way to bolster that the supply of that vitamin in your body and support your immune function, which by virtue of having a stronger immune system on that front and having a well-maintained immune system, well-oiled immune system, that makes it more able to respond to pathogens, including SARS-CoV-2. Would vitamin D supplements guarantee that you're not going to get a severe infection? No, I do not believe that's the case. And there have been several clinical trials looking at vitamin D throughout the pandemic, and they did not garner strong evidence that supplementation makes a huge difference in terms of treating COVID-19 or preventing it. So even if you take vitamin D supplements, you can still be equally vulnerable to catching the virus. So that might be why it's not as highlighted, especially as compared to new treatments that are being developed specifically for the coronavirus. I am getting a question about someone who has had COVID-19 back in early May. So it's now July, but he's now suffering from extreme fatigue and seems like heart rate issues. This is a highly individualized question, so I'm going to defer specific guidance to a healthcare provider. I am not a medical professional, so I will not be giving you medical advice today on that front, especially for specific people. I'm not aware of your medical history. I will highlight here that there are many cases being reported of people who have COVID-19, seem to recover from the virus itself, so that initial infection, but are left with long-term or perhaps even chronic health conditions afterwards. So there's been many reports of people feeling especially fatigued, tiring quickly when they exercise, feeling dizzy, things of this nature. And these weren't necessarily people who had health conditions before they caught the virus. So what we're going to see is as more and more people catch this thing, you might see a whole new group of people emerging from the pandemic with chronic conditions of some sort, or at least seeing for the next couple months after recovery, some sort of elongated period of at least fatigue, if not other symptoms that recur through time. Some people have even had waves of symptoms similar to what they had while they had the virus. So some people have had recurring bouts of fever or digestive issues, in addition to their fatigue and other problems. So if you do have COVID-19 now and feel poorly even a month after recovering, that's certainly something to bring to your doctor and seek specific treatment for those symptoms following. And this is not completely unexpected. We do see that severe, especially among severe viral infections, that people can experience these long-term problems following. A percentage of people will experience that during this pandemic. And if you're one of those, mostly I imagine it's going to be symptomatic treatments that your doctor will provide, addressing the specific symptoms that you experience following the infection. But it may be that you've developed a whole new condition as a result of having the virus, and that might require specific treatments to be given. So that's definitely something to follow up on. I'm getting the question, is it possible to be tested too early for the virus and get a false negative back as a result? And the answer is yes, that is a possibility. That's also true of other viral infections. Sometimes if you get tested for something too early, you won't necessarily be clocked as positive just because the amount of virus inside you is not very high yet. So the chances of catching it on a swab become lower. So it's recommended that if you have a known point of exposure, you might wait between about 4 to 7 days to go get tested, because that's when your viral load, if you are infected, will begin to rise. Now, if you're experiencing symptoms, get tested right away. Especially if you're experiencing symptoms, your viral load is likely high enough that they would be able to detect it. But if you are asymptomatic and simply know that you've had close contact with someone, you might wait a few days. Or, for instance, we were recommending that anyone going out protesting in previous weeks might wait a few days after a protest to go get tested in case they were infected. Now, if you receive a call from a contact tracer in your state, contact tracers are hired to call up all the close contacts of people who have tested positive for the virus. If they call you up, as part of the protocol, they help you figure out when you are likely exposed and when you should go get tested. So just know that if you do receive a call that suggests you were potentially exposed to the virus, they should help you work through exactly when you should go get tested. I'm getting a follow-up question to the brain inflammation I was talking about earlier. So this person is asking if the virus crossed the blood-brain barrier. So the blood-brain barrier, for anyone who doesn't know, is this layer of tissue that prevents the blood that circulates through the body from directly interfacing with the brain. So it's this protective barrier that only lets certain substances through, and that is meant to be protective of the brain tissue because it's a very sensitive organ in that respect. So what they're finding so far is that there's not evidence of the virus itself within the cerebrospinal fluid, which is the liquid that saturates the brain and also the spinal cord. So they're not finding evidence of the virus within that fluid that circulates in the brain. So what they're thinking is that just the amplified inflammation throughout the body, which is, this is seen in other severe viral infections as well, that inflammation is reaching the brain and those inflammatory substances are kicking off an immune response that then damages the brain tissue and the nerves found within. So that's a great question. So at this point, it doesn't seem like the virus is crossing the blood-brain barrier. Early on, they thought that the symptoms of smell loss could potentially be connected to within your nose. There's a structure called the cribriform plate, which is simply where your olfactory nerves, which allow you to smell things, come through your nose and pick up scents and process them. But that cribriform plate that the nerves pass through is a very easy point of access for pathogens and debris and other problems. So they've connected other brain damage to infection through that access point in the nose. So there was some speculation as to whether the virus could get through the olfactory nerve and into the brain that way. At this point, it doesn't seem like there's been follow-up studies that show that that's a strong possibility, but I think people are still actively looking into that. So that might, the information I'm telling you now might change. But at this point, it seems more likely that it's inflammatory substances that get through the blood-brain barrier or else are called there by the immune system and damage the brain in that way. I'm getting a repeated question about hydroxychloroquine. sorry I didn't answer you before. We get to questions as we can in the midst of this brief live stream. At this point, now early on, this particular drug got a lot of play because it was mentioned by President Trump in multiple addresses, and people were actively looking into hydroxychloroquine as a potential treatment for COVID-19. At this point, it does not seem to confer any benefit as a preventative, so taken before you catch the virus, or as a treatment for the virus. Now, there are scattered studies that are still looking into this a bit, but there have been fairly large clinical trials at this point that don't suggest that there's a benefit, and also suggest that if you are given too high a dose of hydroxychloroquine or the related drug chloroquine, that you can suffer serious side effects, which were known about before. So these drugs are given for conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus specifically. So they dampen the activity of the immune system. But specifically, they thought hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine might help treat SARS-CoV-2 because there was previous studies of the related SARS-CoV virus that suggested that the drugs could stop the virus from replicating in laboratory studies and animal studies. So there was some thought and some promise to the drugs at the start, but to get to a therapeutic dose that actually helps people, it doesn't seem like any of the doses they've tried have been helpful therapeutically. So sometimes what you see in a lab dish doesn't translate to people in that respect. That's why we go through these preclinical studies in lab dishes, then animal studies, then a small group of humans, then a larger group of humans, to try to make sure that everyone's as safe as possible as you go along with the highest efficacy at the lowest dose possible. Lots of research has already been done on this front, and they're finding that it does not benefit people and in fact can harm people and cause heart arrhythmias. And if you take hydroxychloroquine at too high a dose, it can also damage your eyes. Again, all known side effects of the drugs. And I believe those with liver conditions are recommended not to take it at all. So given this kind of tenuous safety profile that we knew about before, and the fact that it doesn't confer benefit in these large trials, most trials have ceased at this time and people aren't looking into it as a promising medication anymore. I'm going to wrap up on one more question. Again, I can't get to everyone's questions in the course of this live stream, but many of these topics are discussed in thorough detail on the Live Science website, livescience.com, as well as our forums, forums.livescience.com. Okay, final question. Someone's asking, how long after someone tests positive and they go through the 15 or so days of quarantine, can they go back and be retested and show a negative result? Now, there is some, most of the diagnostic tests, what they're doing is detecting genetic material from the virus. And by detecting that genetic material, sometimes you can get a false result because it can still detect the virus circulating in your body, but you might not have an active infection anymore. It may just be that dead or inactivated virus is still circulating in your bloodstream because it does take some time for the body to clear all that after you actually recover from the infection. At this point, if you get tested at the end of quarantining for about 2 weeks and you truly are negative for the virus, your viral load should be low enough that most of the time you would get a negative result back. That said, there is always some chance that you would get a false positive simply because you have circulating virus in your body still, even if you don't have an active infection. So if you doubt the results of the test, you might ask to be tested twice, and that is a possibility in some places and not all. But because, of course, the diagnostic tests are not 100% accurate, in many hospital systems, they go to the trouble of testing people more than once to guarantee that the feedback they're getting is correct. So you might ask if you get a positive result, but you have gone through the quarantining, you're fully recovered, all that sort of thing, you might ask to be tested a second time to make sure that first result was right. So I won't say that it's guaranteed that you'll test negative because there's no guarantee in these matters, but you might be recommended to be tested more than once. And on that note, I'm going to wrap up this week's live stream. Thank you again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.